I'll send a resource committee to order. April 28th, time is 3:40. Members present, Senator Stevens, Senator Stedman, Senator Elton, Senator Dyson, and myself, Senator Wagoner. First order of business today is House Bill 304, Commercial Fishing Loan Program. Will the sponsor please present the bill? Mr. Coghill, fancy meeting you here again.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. This is my week for the Senate, I can tell you. This one's been quite a work in progress. Just to let you know, my first intention when I began this process 5 years ago really was to put the Division of Investments out of the lending business. But as I began to wander into it, that was my philosophy, was the government shouldn't be in the lending business. But as I began to wander into it, it was at the time when we had the serious downturn in fishing pricing. I became convinced that there's a significant need for this program. But I also wanted to make sure that it was a lender of last resort, the best we could do. So this particular bill changes application processes in that you have to be turned down by a federally recognized lending institution, and also to include the Commercial Fishing and Agricultural Bank, CFAB. Upper limit for refinancing the loans, I went from $300,000 to $200,000. The change in the loan rate, I started off with prime plus two and let it float, but on the House side, I agreed to allow a cap of 10.5%, so it would be prime two up to 10.5%. That was not my first choice, but that's just the reality of what I had to do to move it along. It reduces the collateral from the loan collateral necessary from 90% to 80%, which I think brings it into industry practices a little better, and increases the federal tax loan capacity from $30,000 to $35,000, which I think is appropriate given the economy we're in. And fishing quotas, the one point here, excluding the purchase of fishing quotas by quota entities, the total outstanding loan for a borrower can exceed $400,000. So it would aggregate the quotas, your fishing gear, and your permit capacity to $400,000. If you have a family that has two fishermen within that family, for example, husband and wife team, that would be able to, they would be able to, I think, if I remember correctly, do that. That changes it down from $930,000, basically. And I'm looking at this fiscal note. I think they adjusted that number some. No, I think that is still $930,000. So you have a restated fiscal note. It's still a zero fiscal note, but I think they cleaned up some of the language there. They recommend that it estimate that they would result in one less loan per year, totaling about $68,000. And I'll let them talk to it, but that's pretty much the focus of the bill. My focus has been to try to tighten up the practices and make it a lender of last resort to the best that I understood the banking business. I've worked long and hard with the Division of Investments. I've worked long and hard with the Commercial Fishing Revolving Funding Fund and CFAB, have come to what I think is probably a compromise position that is reasonable. And so with that, Mr. Chairman, I'd be glad to entertain questions or let the testimony go.
Thank you. Are there questions of the bill sponsor? Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Section 4 of the bill was a repealer, and it repeals small loans for repairs and refurbishing, which would, I think, of existing vessels and stuff. I'm just kind of curious why that was repealed. Is there problems with that, or you feel that they should be going somewhere else, or there's no demand for it, or?
I'd probably let the department speak to it first, but that's my understanding, is that it allows them to reallocate that money.
Yeah, that's 10% set aside.
Yeah, it was. with 10% that was carved out, set aside for specific issues. This just frees it up for general uses. I think it still allows that use.
Okay.
Additional questions?
Is there a representative from the department here?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Greg Winninger, Director of the Division of Investments. As Representative Coghill explained, we've been working with him on this bill for quite some time, and we certainly appreciate his willingness to listen to the concerns that we had with the original bill. Basically, what we've tried to do is come up with some changes that we could make to the program that would address his concerns, but at the same time wouldn't adversely impact this fund. Or the borrowers that use it. This fund's been around for, well, since the early 70s, basically, and it's been a very successful program. It's helped thousands of Alaskans. Basically, about 6,000 people have gotten loans through this program. The fund is completely self-sufficient, doesn't use any general fund. In fact, it has been like that since the mid-80s, and it's also actually returning money to pay for other programs at this point. So anytime you talk about changes, we want to look at those changes pretty carefully, and we have done that, and the CS that you have in front of you, we are comfortable with. We do not feel it's going to adversely impact the borrowers or the fund itself. In regards to the question from Senator Stedman, basically the repealer said that we had to hold back 10% of the funds to ensure that we had enough money to make smaller type loans of $35,000 or under. And that has not been an issue at all with this fund. We've had plenty of cash flow to handle all those requests. So it's basically just removing that because it really hasn't been necessary. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have or committee members might have.
Let's see. I have one first. I'm trying to think of how to phrase this. From the institution of this program, how many loans have gone in arrears and never been paid?
Mr. Chairman, I don't have the totals on that. I can tell you the delinquency rate right now is about 4.9%. We have a very low delinquency rate. Of course, over the years when we had tough times and with prices and dealing with farm fish and all of that, we had a number of people that had difficulties. One of the great things about this program is the legislature built in a tremendous amount of flexibility into this program so that we had ways that we could work with individuals and help them through those tough times. And fortunately, we were able to help a large number of people. But we have had defaults. We have had to take permits back, as you know. But because of that flexibility, we've been able to minimize that to a pretty good extent.
I'd like to be able to receive a report that reflects what the history has been. I happen to be one of them guys that had some hard times too, but I never missed a payment.
Right.
So I'd kind of like to look at that.
I would certainly be happy to provide
Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Maybe we could get a little bit of testimony on the CDQ program and for the communities and how that is going to be capped or modified by this bill and what impacts may come about from that.
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, this bill will not cap CDQ loans, so to speak. What it does do is there are several different sections that you can borrow money under, and there is right now you could actually, by combining these different sections, you could borrow up to $930,000 total. That would be an extremely unusual situation. In fact, we only really have one borrower that's over $400,000 in total loans. But what this bill would do would be it would take that 930 limit down to 400,000. You can actually borrow 300,000 to buy quota shares at this point, so it really wouldn't impact that part of the program. But what it may impact is somebody that's trying to combine a number of loans and get above the $400,000 limit.
Further questions of Mr. Winninger? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
With that, there's I guess Mr. Winninger was the only person signed up to give testimony, so seeing nobody else, I'm going to close
public hearing, see if there are any questions from the committee.
Is there a motion? Senator Elton?
Mr. Chair, I'd move with individual recommendations, committee substitute for House Bill 304, with the attached fiscal note.
Is there any objection? Senate Bill 304 will move to the next committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Signed in your spot.
Under here.
Senate Bill 4?
Under the yellow one there.
What is it?
There's three of them. Here's an addition.
Okay, but we gotta present the bill first, so.
Yes, sir.
Okay, next bill in front of us is the, Senate Bill 314.
Sponsor's staff here.
Good afternoon. I'm Brian Hove, staff to Senator Seekins. He apologizes he couldn't be here today. Senate Bill 314 amends Alaska Statute 3805-183F so as to disallow retroactive adjustments in the sale price of royalty oil where a TAPS transportation rate change has occurred. This legislation corrects an unintended consequence resulting from the state's filing of a protest with the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission regarding interstate tariff rates on the Trans-Alaska pipeline system. The effect of the state's filing from January 1st, 05 forward is to create a potential retroactive payment for any in-state refinery purchasing state royalty oil under the FERC case until the FERC case is settled. This could be as late as August of 09. Though the state is a signer to both the 10-year royalty oil contract with Flint Hills Resources Alaska, effective April 1st of 04, as well as the TAPS settlement methodology, which governs TAPS rates through 09, the state chose to challenge the TSM prior to 09, thus creating retroactivity potential for the Flint Hills refinery in North Pole. With up to 5 years to settle the case with FERC, accumulated retroactive liability could reach $200 million or more. This has caused Flint Hills to cancel a $175 million clean fuels project and a $91 million naphtha stabilizer project. In addition, low-margin products such as naphtha have been discontinued in 06, and Flint Hills is purchasing 10,000 barrels less per day of state royalty oil for which a premium is paid. This has also resulted in the loss of approximately $7 million in shipping revenue for the Alaska Railroad and $1 million in fuel flowage fees for the Port of Anchorage. Flint Hills is also not able to provide long-term contracts to fuel customers such as Golden Valley Electric Association because of the uncertainty caused by potential retroactivity. Senate Bill 314 eliminates this uncertainty for buyers of state royalty oil and encourages investment in product production decisions to be based on genuine market factors rather than the prospect of tariff retroactivity. It also restores fairness in terms of avoiding retroactivity with respect to raw materials that have long since been manufactured and sold into the marketplace. With that, Chair Wagner, we have Mr. Cook here from Flint Hills who would speak to it. I think we also have the Department of Natural Resources here, Mr. Banks, to speak to it. I suspect you have some people online there as well. If you have any questions, I'd be willing to take a shot at it.
Is there any questions this time?
Maybe some afterwards.
Okay. Mr. Cook, you want to come forward?
Good
Thank you, Senator Wagner and members of the Resource Committee. My name is Jeff Cook, and I'm Director of External Affairs for Flint Hills Resources, Alaska. Flint Hills operates the largest refinery in Alaska, supplying a variety of refined products for both interior Alaska and beyond. We export about 90% of what we produce each day on the Alaska Railroad south. Jet fuel comprises the majority of our daily production, and we supply just over 50% of the jet fuel consumed at the Anchorage, Ted Stevens International Airport in Anchorage. We appreciate the opportunity that we have to speak to you today about Senate Bill 314. We have worked for over a year with the Department of Natural Resources on this issue. We appreciate that opportunity. We've supplied them with as much information as possible. However, due to both antitrust considerations and proprietary issues, we have not been able to provide them with the detailed pricing and contract information that they requested. But fortunately, this is really a very simple situation, and detailed figures are not necessary to understand that tariff retroactivity is mutually harmful to our refinery, to our customers, and to the state of Alaska. Tariff retroactivity was addressed in our royalty oil contract with the state, and Flint Hills considered this issue in our purchase economics for the refinery. What we did not expect was that the state would protest the tariff setting mechanism, the TAP settlement methodology, prior to the expiration of the TSM agreement at the end of 2009, considering that the state is a signatory to that agreement. In fact, we would expect them to vigorously defend TSM. In January of 2005, and again in January of 2006, the state has joined in the protest of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission on those tariffs. This litigation could go on with the appeals as long as August of 2009. In the meantime, there's an annual potential liability to Flint Hills of up to $50 million per year that starts in January of 2005. And this is a liability we have to face and we have to address and put as a potential charge on our financial statements. Well, we brought this issue up with DNR in March of 2005 and indicated the negative consequences that would occur because of the pending case with FERC. As you can imagine, any business facing such a large annual and cumulative retroactivity would have to make adjustments in their business operation. We asked the DNR to work with us and gave them a number of options beginning a year ago to mitigate the mutually harmful negative consequences of retroactivity. We were not able to reach agreement with DNR, and as a consequence, as mentioned by the sponsor statement, we have canceled projects totaling over $260 million for clean fuels and for a naphtha stabilizer. And the DNR may tell you that that was because of increasing costs, and I can tell you costs everywhere have increased. We've got two other refineries. We're doing multi-million dollar expansions there, and those costs likewise have escalated, but we are not facing uncertainty of retroactivity. This cancellation of the projects resulted in both construction job losses and full-time job losses. We do have to analyze our business each day based on the price accrued, world market for our products, and the margins we realize in each one of our product lines. As mentioned, as we analyzed naphtha for 2006, the already thin margins on that product, which we were exporting about 12 cargoes a year out of Anchorage, was so thin that if you applied retroactivity, it was a negative margin. Anyone in our position would make the same decision. You don't make a product that you're not potentially going to make money on. As a result, we're purchasing 10,000 barrels a day less of crude oil per day from the state under our contract. This is a loss to the state as we do pay them a premium on the RIK crude we purchase. In addition, since we are not shipping south, it's already been mentioned, the Alaska Railroad is losing approximately $7 million a year in revenue in 2006. For as long as we're not exporting that project, and also the Port of Anchorage, and I believe there's someone online to testify to those consequences. Also, Golden Valley is completing some new turbines at the North Pole. They'd like to have a five-year contract for the naphtha. When we don't know what the price of our product is, we cannot provide them the long-term contract for naphtha or for the HAGO that they burn in the current generation that's already there. This hurts GVA, it hurts us, and it hurts the GVA customer base. As we look at our product lines on a day-to-day basis, we also have to analyze asphalt for the 2006 construction season and beyond. We cannot give our customers the prices and the certainty and product availability that they both desire and deserve. As a consequence, this impacts the road building and upgrade programs for the roads in the interior of Alaska for the coming season and beyond. In the handout we provided, you can see that low-complex refineries such as ours struggle to stay in business. Many such refineries have closed in the last 26 years. We do not want to be on that chart in the future. Historically, our refinery has been able to stay profitable because of our crude cost advantage over the West Coast. That crude cost advantage is eliminated with large retroactive payments. The history of Flint Hills and our parent company, Koch Industries, is to grow the assets they own. Flint Hills not only wants North Pole Refinery to survive, but to grow and expand in the future. And the history, if you look on those charts we provided of refineries that do not grow, is that they do not survive. This legislation puts the state at a crossroads. The state can take the path of supporting and passing the legislation to the mutual benefit of a host of beneficiaries, or the state can continue on the path of a public policy that maintains tariff retroactivity and continues more of the negative results I've described above. If you look at the total impact of retroactivity, you will conclude the long-term losses are far greater than any windfall retroactive payment the state might receive in the future. The multiplier impact of the losses, such as those to the Alaska Railroad, go far beyond $7 million a year. And even if one agreed with the EBITDA figures that DNR presents you are correct, the annualized EBITDA figures as a percentage of what they project as our income is huge. It's enough to stifle the incentive investment for any business. I urge you to support this legislation and work for its adoption by the legislature. The legislation will provide equity, fairness, and certainty for any purchaser of state royalty oil. It is patently unfair for any business to be subject to retroactivity for raw materials they have long since manufactured and sold. The bill will eliminate uncertainty for buyers of state royalty oil and encourage investment decisions and product production decisions based on legitimate market factors, not on the prospect of tariff retroactivity. Such legislation might even encourage other companies to bid on state royalty oil in the future. Thank you for your consideration of our request to support Senate Bill 314. Online are Tony Cementelli, Executive Vice President and Chief Financial Officer for Flint Hills Resources, Alan Wright, Vice President of Public Affairs for Flint Hills Resources, and Travis Pearson, Senior Counsel for Flint Hills Resources. And they are available to assist in answering any questions or make comments as appropriate if we get into technical areas that get beyond my capabilities. Thank you, and be glad to answer any questions.
Who did you have other than said Tony? Who else?
Tony Cementelli, Alan Wright, and Travis Pearson.
Senator Dyson.
Yeah, thank you. For my benefit and perhaps some of the folks that are listening, would you give us a little kind of a summary of how these pipeline tariff challenges, what happens? It would seem to me that the owners of the pipeline have charged a rate for shipping in their pipe, and if FERC comes back and decides they were overcharging, why isn't it the owners of the pipeline that have to owe the state as opposed to you, the shipper?
Through the chair, Senator Dyson, I'm not sure I can answer that question. Maybe Tony Cementelli or someone else can, or DNR, but certainly it's part of our contract. Tony?
Yes, thank you for hearing us, Senator. The way the tariff works is we start with a delivered West Coast price for AS. It's a market discoverable price that is published. And then there are deductions for marine freight, which in our particular case, we have a fixed differential for that with the state. And then you deduct the pipeline tariff to get to a Prudhoe Bay value. So the lower the tariff, the higher the amount we pay for the crude oil at Prudhoe Bay, and then we take the barrel from the state and move them to our refinery on the intrastate rate. So I know it sounds somewhat counterintuitive that that the lower the rate, the more we pay, because one would assume we're shipping, but that's true for the intrastate rate. I don't know, did that answer your question, or because it's a deduction from the published price?
No.
Okay.
Tony, before we go any further, please state your name and your title, who you work for.
Sorry about that.
For the record.
My name is Tony Cementelli, and I'm the CFO of Flint Hills Resources. I guess the easiest way maybe to do this is to get an example. Let's say the West Coast, the price of ANS, $50 in California. The way we get an Alaska price is to deduct marine transportation, which we've agreed with the state to use $1.55, and then we deduct the tariff. So let's assume that's $4 for simple math. It would be $60 less $1.55 less $4 would get you to the price we pay the state of Alaska. There's some other pricing terms in there, but those are the major terms. So if the tariff is reduced to $2, our deduction from the West Coast is lower. Therefore, the more we would have to pay the state for crude oil.
Yeah, no, I've understood that for a long time. But it wasn't your company that set the rate, and it wasn't your company that may have overcharged the shipping in the pipe. So why is it your company that is being required to pay the delta as opposed to the company, the pipeline owners, who were overcharging?
That's a very good question. The reason is we have indexed our crude oil contract to these published tariffs. So we use this pricing term as a proxy to get a value to pay the state. So it's somewhat like a posting price that we're just picking up. So this tariff could be adjusted with us not even participating in it. And we don't ship any barrels on the long haul interstate rate. So we're just subject to this as a pricing term.
Yeah, there's something I'm missing. If the pipeline company collected too much for the cost of shipping the pipe, why don't they have to pay it back if they were overcharging instead of you guys?
Well, because they would have to do that on any barrels that were actually shipped long haul or interstate. We're not actually shipping those barrels interstate. We're just using that as a pricing term. Therefore, we can't go and recover the overcharge because we didn't ship barrels on that space.
Okay. And I assume that the cost of shipping the barrels you take to Fairbanks or North Pole, you do pay some tariff for that, and that's not what's in contention here.
That's absolutely correct, sir.
All right, thank you.
Okay. You have more presentation? Okay, are there questions, Mr. Cook? Senator Elton.
Thanks, Mr. Chair, and Jeff, or maybe Tony. I mean, one of the things that caught my eye in the fiscal note prepared by Department of Natural Resources was their contention, and if I remember correctly, I think I agree with their contention. It says that when Flint Hills and the state negotiated the contract in 2004, both sides were aware that RCA, the Regulatory Commission of Alaska, had 2 years earlier found that the methodology, the TAPS tariff methodology, was flawed. And I mean, this was commonly reported even in the popular press. So I think what the state may be suggesting in this one paragraph in their fiscal note is that this shouldn't have caught anybody by surprise post-contract period, that, you know, that everybody knew that the RCA had already determined that the tariff valuation method was flawed. And the RCA had challenged that, and I guess I would be interested in your response to that assertion in the fiscal note.
Through the chair, Senator Elton, flawed it may be, but the state was may or may not be, but the state was a signer to TSM, and as a signer of that contract, then we don't expect them to go out and oppose that prior to the expiration at the end of 2009. So. Tony, do you have additional comment besides that?
Yes, Senator Elton, and I do believe that's a very good question. A lot has been made of us signing the deal, and to be very open, this is why we're actually here. I mean, Foothills Resources is going to live by its deal. We know we signed this retroactivity. The point that we're trying to make is twofold, and I'll address both of them. One is that the RCA has no jurisdiction on interstate rates. We talked at great lengths with the DNR about these rates during the negotiation process. They recognized they were a signer to TSM and told us that they expected TSM to go to term. That all said, the RCA decision is not final. At this particular time, that decision is still on appeal. We don't know how it's actually going to play out. And that decision was 4 years ago. So theoretically speaking, well, maybe not theoretically, practically speaking, we could get a decision in 06 or 07 that's final that says the RCA was not correct in this particular ruling. What we're trying to say, and this is my second point, is running a refinery 5 years in arrears is not a good way to run a business. We don't know what our costs are, and what this policy has done is forced us to try and avoid retroactive payments. There's two ways to avoid retroactive payments, and that is, one, to work proactively with the DNR and the state to address the concerns that Jeff brought forward. The second way that we have control in our own hands is to reduce production that puts less barrels at risk of retroactivity, and unfortunately, that's what we've had to do. The history of our company is to invest in growth, and refining is a very capital-intensive business that needs continuous reinvestment, and this policy has told us to run for more minimum type of investment to try and wait till we have a certainty on our fruit costs. And as the RCA decision has shown, you have to wait years and years and years. People have talked about 2009 as a potential outcome to this. I'm not totally certain that's going to be the case. This could go on for years. If you use the Quality Bank as an example, that case was initiated in 1993, and it's not yet final. So the FERC has not shown a sense of urgency to rule in a final way that comes to an outcome on how to run the business.
So, Mr. Chair,
Senator Elton,
if I could follow up, Tony, thanks for your explanation. I mean, I think the scary thing for me is that if the fiscal note is based upon the premise that it's about a $50 million hit a year, if you're talking about a potential decision being way out into the future, you're talking about the potential financial impact of the state being much greater than $100 million.
You're absolutely correct, sir, and that's true. And if this thing goes out years and years and years, this retroactivity bill will be larger than potentially we paid for the refinery. And so we can't run a business where we may have a retroactive liability larger than the actual cost of the physical assets in which we've acquired. So we're very concerned about what is the ultimate production rate that we want to continue to operate at.
And Mr. Chair, one more question, and either for Jeff or for Tony. I mean, explain for me. I mean, I have a fairly basic understanding of your business, but there are other refineries. I'm assuming the other refineries are they buying their product on the open market instead of from the state, and in fact, if this goes through, would you be able to produce a product for less cost and be more competitive because they're buying in the open market?
Well, I can't speak to the exact costs of our competitors. I don't know those. But see, we are at a competitive disadvantage. Well, we're currently, the way it sits today, we are very competitive with the Kenai refinery, because what happens is we get a crude oil discount, but then we pay the Alaska Railroad approximately $2.50 a barrel to get most of our product to Anchorage. So if you put us on a parity to Valdez, which is what the decreased tariff really does, what we have to do is pay what our competitors are paying for crude oil, plus $2.50 to the railroad to get to market. other than the small amount of production that we leave in Fairbanks. So there is no question against the Kenai refinery we would be competitively disadvantaged. That's a slam dunk because we have to pay both the higher tariff and the railroad cost. As far as PetroStar economics, being their integration with their parents, I don't know how their cost structure works. I don't know how much of their own crude oil they're running.
Further questions? Any further comments?
No, appreciate very much the opportunity to speak. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cook. With that, I'd like to have Kevin Banks come forward from the Department of Natural Resources.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Senators of the Senate Resources Committee. For the record, my name is Kevin Banks. I'm the petroleum market analyst for the Department of Natural Resources, Division of Oil and Gas, and head of the commercial section there. I'm afraid you've saved the least articulate for last, so I apologize if I stumble and fumble a bit, but let me try to.
I don't think you're going to be last, Mr. Banks. So.
Well, okay. But maybe still the least articulate. But let me try to shine a light through a different facet of this prism. A lot of what you've heard from Flint Hills, I have no qualms with. I think they've been pretty forthright about their concerns. On the other hand, I wanted to share with you a little bit more detail and the perspective that I think that that the Department of Natural Resources is taking in this. Clearly, the choice for the state when we decided to sell oil to Flint Hills was the decision to take oil that would normally be paid for by the lessees in value. In other words, as companies like BP, Exxon, and ConocoPhillips take their oil to the lower 48 and sell it, we have the advantage of their business and their calculated royalty values in which they pay us cash. Those contracts and the arrangements that we have for those lessees include retroactive provisions. I might add, in fairness to Flint Hills, and in somewhat touching on the issues that Senator Dyson raised, when our lessees ship oil to the lower 48, they're paying an interstate tariff. And so that when the interstate tariff, this temporary and temporary tariff is adjusted downward, and the FERC rules that it should be paid retroactively, why then they do get a refund from the pipeline company. Sometimes it's the same company as the lessee, but they'll get a refund from the pipeline company and they'll pass that refund on to us. So there's where the basis of our decision to sell oil to Flint Hills begins. We have under our regulations a provision that says that when negotiating contracts with potential RAK buyers, that we may not sell our royalty for less than what we receive for it in value. And so clearly, although we tried to make a contract with Flint Hills that had as few moving parts as possible, the tariff allowance and the quality bank allowance were left with retroactive provisions in them. And although there may be some discussion about who thought what when they made the deal, one of the things that we recognized is that in insisting on a retroactive provision in our contract, that there was items traded away, I think, in one specific one that I've mentioned already in my notes, but also in the case of interest. Under normal circumstances, interest would accrue from the time that the payment was made. I should say when the accrual of the payment was required. But with in the case of Flint Hills, when we invoice Flint Hills for the retroactive payment, such as it happens, that's when interest begins to run. So they'll enjoy some break on interest from the time from today through the point at which we finally get around to invoicing them should the retroactive adjustment be required. To put this into some context, we received from Flint Hills $1.2 billion for oil that they purchased from us last year. That represents 56% of our royalty revenue. So Flint Hills is undoubtedly the biggest royalty payer in the state, and by far much larger than the royalty in value lessee payers. Over time, the amount of oil that will be reserved for this contract will become a larger percentage of the amount of royalty oil that we anticipate producing, such that by the end of this contract, nearly 80% of royalty oil will be reserved and devoted to this contract should they be able to take it. Now, they'll tell you, and I think correctly so, that they anticipate buying less oil from us in order to avoid the potential retroactive hit that they may have to take under the current the contract is currently written. However, the contract does allow them to take as much as 77,000 barrels a day, so that's 77,000 barrels we can't sell to others. Historically, the state has always had retroactive provisions in their contracts for the reasons I've described, that we can't take a royalty in kind for less than royalty in value. It's been an issue for other purchasers, and I've been told certainly by other purchasers that they're not interested in buying oil from us as long as the supply of oil can be had from someone else because of the retroactivity issue. So I raise that only to indicate that here we'll be put in a position, if SB 314 passes, of now offering new contracts to new purchasers, but with only a very limited amount of oil to sell to them, in backing up Flint Hills, and with the remaining 44% to 20% of oil left over to sell to others. So there's a question of fairness in that issue, I think. Let me also say, too, that in addition to our regulation, there is a constitutional issue that we've been that has been described to us. I'm sorry.
Did you just say that if this bill passes, that new companies that bought oil from us would not be subject to the retroactivity, but that Flint Hills still would be?
No. What I said, Senator, is that this bill will require that the state sell oil without a retroactive provision in it.
Yes.
That will be a very attractive deal for Tesoro and perhaps even Petrostar and other purchasers. What I am saying is that now there's not a large quantity of royalty oil available to sell to them, and they may not. In selling oil to Flint Hills, in our own finding, we had indicated that that there wasn't competition for this crude oil at, as it was sold to them, and now we can't supply other refineries with their needs.
And if I may,
Senator Dice, yeah.
And by implication, then, in addition to getting excused from these retroactivity payments, we would, by passing this bill, would have made the existing Flint Hills contract a significantly more attractive one than what they bargained for.
I believe that's what they are saying, certainly, because now we don't have this overhang of a $50 million potential lump sum payment that they'll have to pay. No doubt about it. I think that makes their contract more attractive.
And when they, if I may, when they bid on this contract, was it more than just a bidding on the amount they would pay us per barrel?
Well,
was there a lump sum involved in winning this contract?
Senator Dyson, through the chair, technically speaking, there wasn't a bidding process here. The contract was designed, as Mr. Tony Cimentelli indicated, based on a negotiated price, starting with ANS spot price minus the appropriate deductions. There was no lump sum provision in it. If I may continue with my remarks.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Elton.
I don't know if Senator Dyson was done, but I'd like to follow up on what I think I understood in response to his question. And Kevin, you can tell me if I'm right, that if in fact we pass this bill that negates the retroactivity provision, that the state would then be compelled to sell to other royalty in kind to others without a retroactive, giving them the same kind of deal. And earlier you had said that the contract provided for up to 77,000 gallons, but there may not, so there may not be enough royalty or oil in kind to provide to others?
Through the chair, Senator Elton, that's basically true. I think, first of all, SB 314 says that the state may not write contracts with retroactive provisions. And any existing contract, as for example the Flint Hills contract, the only one that we have, would also receive that benefit. So going forward, 77,000 barrels today represents about 56% of all of the royalty that we produce on the North Slope. And through time, as production falls, that 77,000 barrel reservation will become a larger percentage of that. If a company like Tesoro, or Tesoro is probably the best example, has an appetite for more crude than we have, we won't be able to meet their requests. They'd still have to go into the private market to supply their crude oil needs.
So the sweeter, Mr. Chair, I think the sweeter deal then is kind of locked in, because we've locked in at 77,000
barrels.
Barrels.
Gallons.
But, yeah, I'm sorry, did I say gallons?
You said gallons.
We've locked in at 77,000. And so that's those companies that opted to buy on the open market couldn't, I mean, they might want to get back in because retroactivity is gone, but there may not be oil to sell them.
I can also add, Mr. Chairman, another problem with the reservation clause in, or the concept of a reservation of 77,000 barrels. Nominations are made once a month based on a 77,000 barrel per day or whatever. I mean, they do have a window between 56,000 and 77,000 barrels in which Flint Hills may take from us. During the summer months, production on the North Slope falls seasonally. It's also at the same time when Flint Hills' demand for products rise, particularly for, and given that, we could see, and the analysis is difficult to do, but I mean, we could see situations where, although on average we have 44% of our royalty available to sell to someone else, there could very well be during the summer months a good deal less than that. And I think that does raise a problem. Mr. Chairman, back on the question of the constitutionality of this issue, and one that I know that the commissioner has expressed to some of you privately, we've been in talking with folks at the Department of Law who have reminded us that in that Article 8, Section 2 requires that when disposing of royalties, we fall under the maximum benefit of the people rule, and all of you, I'm sure, are very familiar with that. In 1980, Judge Compton, in a ruling on the ANS royalty litigation, indicated that what that meant in this particular case was that RIK could not be sold for less than RIV, and he created quite a bright line to that effect. Allowed for no real room to maneuver. Now, I suppose even given that that line may not be quite so bright as that, if attorneys for the state were to argue on behalf of a grayer space than the bright line that Judge Compton ruled on, the way to go about doing that would be to try to strike some, or to be able to demonstrate that in return for selling royalty for less than royalty in kind, for less than royalty in value, if the state received something for it, and that there was a measurable benefit to the state, I could hazard a guess, jobs, those sorts of benefits that people like to see. If we can see a measurable benefit, and if the buyer of the crude oil, in this case Flint Hills, can offer a sufficient commitment and be able to deliver on that benefit, why then, and then lastly, if there's some balance in the case between the benefits you may get which are less tangible perhaps than the $50 million a year that we're talking about here, that there may be space in here where a deal could be struck and not be found unconstitutional. However, having said all of that, that is an issue for us today as we proceed, as to whether or not Judge Compton's view of what RIK can be sold for in the state is, allows us to sell it for less than royalty and value. I think perhaps I should conclude my remarks with that and take any more questions if anybody should have them.
There are additional questions, Mr. Banks?
Senator Elton? Just a quick one. Do you agree with the testimony earlier that, in fact, the decision could be pushed out into the future and your fiscal note may be understated by a significant amount of money?
I think it's fairly reasonable to assume that, given the performance of the FERC in the past, that we may be waiting for quite a long time. I can tell you that a hearing is scheduled on this issue for early in 2007, and that a decision is to be made by the FERC, I think, sometime towards the end of the first quarter of 2007 or April of 2007, and of course that will be subject to judicial appeal, so it could go on for a long time. At $50 million a year, if it lasts as long as the TAP settlement methodology is in place and people continue to protest the tariffs going forward on the basis of the protests before the FERC today, why this could add up to another, a total of 5 years or so of accrued liabilities for Flint Hills.
Senator Dyson.
This is fascinating. So a company bidding to or negotiating a deal to buy our royalty oil it needs to figure into their business plan the fact that the uncertainty of the price they are paying for the raw product, and figure out what envelope that price might wander over during that period. And faced with an uncertainty like this one, have set the money aside just in case it might go against them, that this kind of perfect storm of adverse conditions might happen, and so they ought to have put that into their plan that this might happen. Is that what a prudent company would do?
From what I understand, Senator Dyson, through the chair, is that that is precisely the way an accountant would recommend you take care of this, that it's a reserve against owner equity and unavailable for spending on the refinery here in Alaska or anywhere, that a prudent company would make sure they have the money they'd need should the FERC lower the tariff and require a retroactive adjustment, that requires a retroactive adjustment here. I might also add that in some of my comments, and I've read with interest Flint Hills' response to my comments, there's more to this process than just our retroactivity. Flint Hills has had to adjust its how it makes products in order to meet low sulfur diesel requirements under the EPA, which has constrained its ability to basically thrown it into a choice to either improve the refinery or to acquire low sulfur diesel to meet its customers' requirements by joining together with Tesoro, and which they have done. It turns out to be a more profitable a choice on their part, or perhaps better said, a least costly choice on their part, rather than try to improve their own refinery. Furthermore, on the questions of the ability to supply naphtha both to the local market in Fairbanks and to the export market, that has been largely affected as well by the treatment of naphtha as a cut in the Quality Bank, where before naphtha was relatively less expensive, and it was possible to remove naphtha from the fuel, the oil stream that passes through the refinery, and export it to Asia. With the new Quality Bank, that is going, naphtha will cost Flint Hills much more. So retroactivity undoubtedly is a big chunk. We've talked about numbers of $50 million a year. That is taken right out of their pocket. There's no question about it. The question is, what can they do with it? And I think for the issue that DNR is struggling with is this $50 million that will be returned to the economy of the state of Alaska? And or is it $50 million that will go back to Flint Hills Resources and Wichita and their refinery businesses elsewhere in the lower 48. That's the kind of balance that we need to try to strike.
If I may,
Senator Dyson,
it seems all the more ironic in that the picture I have in my mind is there's kind of two toll roads that the product gets hauled on, or pipe, and they are being forced to make these retroactive payments on a road that they didn't use or a pipe that they didn't use, and arguably would then have less incentive to really be paying attention to, you know, and it wasn't on the provision or portion of the pipe that they were using and the tariff that they were paying. It just adds a degree of difficulty to it. It's it's like they're being penalized by a process that they had no control over, and kind of not even a watchman on the process. And boy, that's a significant uncertainty factor in any business plan, I would assume. Should we worry about that or think about that in terms of fairness?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Dyson, if I may, I don't want to be argumentative, but let me add a fact to your point. Koch Industries owns a piece of this pipeline, and they are engaged in the dispute at the FERC as well to keep the tariff as high as it is. So to say that they're not aware of it or it wasn't on their watch, I think it may not be a correct portrayal of the issue. Undoubtedly, the intrastate tariff is lower. So the transportation between Pump Station 1 and North Pole is based on a lower tariff methodology imposed by the RCA. If you could sell our any kind of oil interstate and deliver it to North Pole, you can't, but a distance adjusted tariff on the interstate would be a higher price. The reason we sell royalty oil to Flint Hills based on the interstate tariff is because that's where our oil goes if it doesn't stay in state. And so the opportunity for the state, and for that matter, anyone who is producing oil on the North Slope, is do you go to the West Coast to sell your oil? In our case, do you leave it in value, or do you sell it in-state to someone else? So the interstate deduction for tariff is, I think, an appropriate deduction. Now we're just caught in the knot where that tariff is now being adjudicated by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Further questions, Mr. Banks? All right. Thank you, Kevin.
Mr. Chairman.
Next, we'll go to the off-net to Governor Bill Sheffield.
Yes, hello. I'm here.
Go ahead, Bill.
Thank you, Senator Wagner.
Yes.
And other members of the Resources Committee. It's been an interesting discussion. I've been sitting here doing a little work and other things while I've been listening a little bit, but I'm not here to suggest how you folks ought to deliberate this or vote, but I thought I would try to tell you what happens to the railroad in the process of this system. I'm the chairman of the board here. I'm also the board director of the Port of Anchorage, so we kind of cover a good bit of the waterfront here. The railroad hauls is hauling 48% of their freight business, is what I want to say. 48% of the revenue freight business for the Alaska Railroad is hauling petroleum from North Pole Refinery. That revenue is about $45 million. And in this year, Twin Hills is scheduled to be down about 15%. That's about what it is. And basically, that takes away the $7 million profit that the railroad might have had. So the railroad's not going to make a profit this year. It's going to be about even. And while our track maintenance and things like that continue on, nothing happened. When you start to compensate for not making a profit, you start to cut expenses. And so while our federal side of the railroad doing track work and things like that we get some money for every year, that continues on. But we're not able to do our real estate development, our fleet modernization, and things of that nature, because we don't have a capital budget of our own, and because our profit is gone. So what happens is they're down 15% this year, and the way I've been listening to the testimony, it might be down 5% again next year, and 5% the next year. And finally, you get to where the railroad will have to prepare for that, and prepare for that starting this year. So we'll have to lay off. We've kind of done a pretty good calculation, and we'll have to do further study. But the management of the railroad is expecting to have to lay off 200 to 208 people. And let me just point out to you what 208 people is. That's out of the non-capital funded part of the capital budget. It's out of the United Transportation Union. That's engineers, firemen, and conductors, and so on and so forth. Dispatchers, people in the locomotive shop, car shop, administration overhead, about 15 out of there, probably 20 to 25 people out of maintenance away. And so what happens is that the ICER study in March 2005, Economic Impact for the Alaska Railroad, states that the Alaska Railroad supports nearly 1,900 Alaska jobs and about $83 million in payroll. 42% of that is railroad jobs, 58% are in other Alaska businesses. And so when you take about 200 positions out of the railroad, an additional 287 out of the non-railroad jobs, you're looking at about $21.5 million a year payroll that wouldn't exist. And so the railroad spends about $108 million in capital operating programs every year. You cut it by a third, you cut out about $32 to $33 million, and you cut that out, plus you cut out another $6.2 million a year payroll of the non-railroad job. So the total, if we got down to 25 to 30% less fuel they're hauling from last year, down 25 to 30%, you're looking at lost jobs of about 687 jobs and lost payroll of about $27 to $28 million. And so it's real hard for the state of Alaska. It would take 5 years, to develop some sort of an industry that would create the kind of jobs that would be lost if we don't somehow or other figure this problem out. And this doesn't even calculate the loss of jobs in Flint Hills and the North Pole economy or the Fairbanks North Star borough tax receipts. And so then you start to figure out, how does Fairbanks get its fuel then? And how does Anchorage get supplied with fuel here? But it's been said in there, some of the testimony, that the port will lose money. Yes, it'll lose money, but it'll pick up some as the tankers are starting to roll in here now from Asia and the lower 48, bringing in jet fuel and other products that won't be shipped in here by Flint Hills. And so we'll pick up our dockage and our tonnage and so on and so forth. But forget the port. What really happens is that it affects an awful lot of people just with the Alaska Railroad. And so I wanted to tell you that and add your woes down there as you try to untangle this thing and figure it out. It's very complicated. But I know it means a lot to the state of Alaska to have a railroad and what it does and the fuel that it hauls. Every jumbo jet that takes off from the Stevens International Airport, freighter, fully loaded, takes 2 1/4 tank cars of jet fuel. And so if you've got a 75 car train coming down, you can just about see that just more than takes care of one day's supply of jets taking off of there. Doesn't say anything about El Mador, but the jets fly over here right now, all the fuel that they use. So it serves a purpose. I wouldn't want you to forget it. I know you won't, and I know you haven't, but I thought this might be interesting to you. Thank you.
Thank you, Governor. Any question of Governor Sheffield? Thanks much for your patience waiting for us to get through with our testimony there, Governor, so you could testify.
Well, thank you, Senator. It was interesting that interesting as the problem unfolds and everybody has a point to make, and it was while we know generally about what the problems are, it was a good outline, I think.
Yeah. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Next, we'll go to Merrick Pierce in Fairbanks, OffNet.
Hi, good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. My name is Merrick Pierce in Fairbanks, Alaska. I've been on hold listening to the discussion. It's been a good, thoughtful discussion. To Senator Wagner, I do appreciate your decided good judgment when you publicly stated your intent to never allow this miserable piece of corporate welfare to ever leave your committee. I am testifying today to simply get a few facts into the record. I describe this horrible legislation as corporate welfare because really there's no better way to describe this. Here are the facts. Flint Hills, the beneficiary of this legislation, to the tune of perhaps $200 million, is owned by Koch Industries. And Koch Industries is the largest privately held corporation in the United States with over $80 billion in annual revenue. And the principal owners of Koch Industries are billionaires Charlie and David Cook, or Koch. And according to Forbes, Charles and David are multi-billionaires who are among the 50 wealthiest Americans. So to sum up, Flint Hills is owned by Koch, and Koch is owned and controlled by the billionaires Charlie and David Koch. Now, Charlie and David claim to be conservatives. David ran for vice president as a Libertarian Party candidate in 1980, and Charlie Koch, he helped found the conservative think tank, the Cato Institute. And I don't disagree with their political leanings one bit. The problem I have is their apparent hypocrisy when it comes to their own self-interest. One of the tenets of their philosophy and the conservative organizations they support is to support the elimination of social welfare programs, claiming that they result in reliance on state undue control of government over individual lives, a position that stands to be correct. But perhaps they would care to explain why welfare for the poor is bad, corporate welfare for billionaires is okay. Now, I doubt they could do so with a straight face. I'd like to refer you gentlemen to page 9 of the contract between Flint Hills and the state of Alaska from 2004, entitled Agreement for the Sale of Royalty Oil Between and Among the State of Alaska and Flint Hills Resources. The contract uses the formula, as you've been discussing, to determine the price of Alaska North Slope crude oil sold, and there are a number of factors such as line loss, quality, tankage adjustments, and tariffs that determine the final price. With regard to the tariff adjustment, here is what the contract says. in very unambiguous, plain terms on page 9, and I'm quoting, the tariff allowance is one of the elements of the price term that is subject to retroactive adjustment, end quote. So Flint Hills knew full well, when they voluntarily entered into this contract, that they should be setting aside a contingency fund when the tariff was revised, such as was discussed between Senator Dyson and Mr. Banks. It's also important to note, Mr. Banks noted as well, that Flint Hills is one of the parent corporate Flint Hills is one of the owners of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, and as such is intimately familiar with the tariff issue. So in summary, please kill this corporate wealth of that legislation and consider utilizing the hundreds of millions this legislation would cost us here in Alaska. In fact, we could spend that entire sum of money just in, it's too bad Senator Seekins isn't here, but here at the committee meeting, but you know, just in Senator Seekins' own district, which I'm in, you know, the roads are in terrible shape. I could name off half a dozen roads that are falling apart. Wouldn't it be better to get our roads in decent shape before giving hundreds of millions to dollars to millionaires living in Minnesota? I think so. And I thank you for your time, Senators.
Thank you, Mr. Pearson. Is there questions? Thank you very much. Next, we'll go to Jan Wilson. Are you just there for answers?
Mr. Chairman, this is Kate Geyer, the chair of the RCA. Commissioner Wilson and I are standing by to provide any insight or answer any questions that you may have about the rate-setting practices of the FERC or of the RCA.
Okay. Thanks, Ms. Geyer. Next, we'll go to Ladd McBride in Fairbanks.
Yes, Ladd McBride, Fairbanks, Alaska. I'm afraid I'm not very sympathetic with Flint Hills. They knew what their expense, this expense item, when they signed the contract. I don't think, in my opinion, I don't think Alaskans should sit back and eat that potential $200 million. Certainly haven't cut any breaks. Flint Hills has certainly not cut any breaks to the Alaskan customers. They've always seem to charge full bore to us, and it's been quite expensive to the point of where up until recently we've been paying a premium for gas that is refined locally over and above what they charge for it in Anchorage. Also the fact that they are all, they've not met any of their obligations or contract requirements that were put upon them by the Governor Murkowski concerning the manufacture of low sulfur fuel. And every day that goes by that we put up with this low quality gasoline costs everybody in Alaska money from the standpoint of degradation of their catalytic converters and so forth. And we have a very expensive program up here. It's called the IM program. That's pretty much based on whether it has been based on keeping it on whether or not Flint Hills provides low sulfur gas to the community. As has been proven nationally, it does goes a long ways in cleaning up our air pollution. We are in good stead now as far as air pollution is concerned. However, we'd be better off getting away from this very expensive inspection program, and to have Flint Hills dragging their feet on it hasn't helped us at all. I don't think that the I think the maximum benefit to Alaskans should be looked at with respect to this committee's handling of this legislation. The fact that I think it's already been pointed out that constitutionally there is a maximum requirement right in the Constitution, and to start giving handouts, as Mr. Pierce has said, corporate handouts with respect to relieving their so-called pain is going to cost us Alaskans quite a bit of money. And I guess with that, I'll hang it up for today.
Thank you very much. Are there questions?
Okay, no questions. Thank you very much for testifying. I've got a listed here in Juneau, Lila Klingart. I think that was on a prior bill. Yeah. So, all right. Well, there's no further testimony, so I'm going to hold this bill. I'm not going to move it. So, with that, this will be the last meeting I have scheduled, unless something dire circumstances comes up. I'd like to thank everybody for the work they've done this year.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
And hopefully we're done for the year, unless the Senate President sends something our way. I don't know how to look.